You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 240 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you as usual in two different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And it might be more fair to say this is an episode 240 of the Pelton Cast. This is a historic episode, an historic episode. We could call it episode 2040 of the Pelton Cast.
Well, I was going to say it's the 1991 Sonics edition, because you'll recall that season Gary Payton was wearing the number 2.
Oh,
so you
wow.
had 240.
Wow. There we go.
And it's timely, because Sean Kemp and Gary Payton in the news, NBA TV airing the special Rain Man in the Glove one-on-one conversation between them Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific time. So be sure to set the DVR for that one.
Uh-huh. Don't tune in. Set your DVR.
You can. I'm just saying. I will not be watching it live, as I assume there will be other basketball games going
Whatever
on.
You do not tune in. Just set your DVR. Watch it on your time. Look, it's fucking 2020. It's 2040.
I can't remember the last time I watched a program live that wasn't sports.
It had to be Game of Thrones for me. It's been a while. No, I've watched, you just like flip through channels and watch TV sometimes. You don't do that?
So
you've never done that?
Very, very rarely. Very rarely, if ever.
Okay.
This is not going to be our TV year in review podcast. Sadly, I don't know when or if we're doing that.
Have we ever done that before?
No, we never have.
Okay.
We don't have
You're
time
just
to
premiering
do
new year in review podcasts right now?
Well, I was going to say, but if you haven't already, be sure to check out our music year in review podcast that dropped on Monday, featuring Tristan talking about the effects of the pandemic on the music industry, our top 10 of 2020, yours under the radar artists, and drawing a lot of discourse on Twitter, the famous Cousin Katie's appearance to talk about her Christmas playlist and the search for the ultimate Christmas playlist.
And, dare I say, I think we actually might have done a good podcast for the first time on this year in review and music. Let's not try to follow it up. But also, I have to say, you and I have like a good, insightful conversation about the year in music, changes that have happened, trends in music. And all of the attention is on, of course, Katie's guest appearance talking about fucking Christmas songs.
Well, there's a reason that she is the two-time reigning Pelton Cast MVP.
God.
Much to your consternation. Should we talk about this week's beer?
Absolutely, we should.
We have, from our friends at Deschutes Brewery, the Jubilee Ale, a festive winter ale.
Wow. And if you've seen some of those billboards around Seattle, I call it the Jubal Ale.
No, I have not seen any billboards.
They're
what am
everywhere.
I at this
they
point?
Are everywhere.
I have missed them.
There's one right by you. It just says Jubal. All massive. You really haven't seen this? They're bordering on, what was the freaking, the show that was happening at Marymore?
Oh boy, what was the name of the show?
Cavalia. It's bordering Kavalia. The Jubal billboards are bordering on Cavalia level. That's how many of them there are.
They were around this time of year, because I recall like when I decided to post about them on either Twitter or Facebook, was I'm pretty sure when I was driving back from a Christmas party. So
there we go.
Timely.
All right. The Deschutes Jubal Ale out of Bend, Oregon, of course. Deschutes, cozy up fireside with this festive winter ale full of spice notes and a robust malt character of toffee and dusted cocoa, and original since 1988.
Now, I don't want to overshadow the Jubal Ale that we're drinking right now, but I went to their website and noticed that right there front and center, they have a Rip City beer for the Blazers that we're going to have to try to check out, the Rip City Lager.
There we go. And also Deschutes Brewery, one of the many locations that in a normal year we would probably go to if we went to Portland during December, and we will not be going to this year.
It is a bummer. I don't know when I'm getting back down to Portland, but it's not going to be for the start of the NBA season, that's for sure. One other follow-up from last week, by the way. Usually when we drink B-Bomb on the podcast, mm-hmm. as we always do in the month of December, we're in doing it in person in splitting the 22-ounce bottle among the two of us. We were not able to do that last week. And listener, do not try to drink an entire 22-ounce bottle of B-Bomb in one sitting at home.
You might have to delete the last 45 minutes of the podcast of us yelling at each other.
You might wake up hungover.
They get facilities!
Having drunk no other alcohol except that one bottle. That's all you need. Oh boy.
That's a good warning. Good warning.
You know, it's a PSA, really. Mm-hmm. Just do not try this at home. Well, we got a light toast this week, but did want to make sure we toasted two Sounders legends, Clint Dempsey and Chad Marshall, the latter of whom was on the sidelines for MLS Cup last weekend. Named two MLS 25 greatest as part of the league's 25th anniversary celebration, along with current Sounders assistant coach, Preki, a former, I believe, two-time MVP of the league. So
I was a little surprised to see Chad Marshall in there.
I mean, he's pretty much considered the greatest defender in MLS history.
That is, I mean, I thought he was great. I didn't realize that he was being, that was a national recognition.
Oh yeah. I mean, he won Defender of the Year three times. So that's a good amount. We skipped food last week because we had so much to talk about in the pod. Thankfully, fewer grievances to air this week. Not zero, but fewer. So we're going to have some time to talk about food and talk about a place we previewed a couple weeks ago now, I think, on the podcast, which is Chengdu Taste, a local opening of a famed LA Chinese and Sichuanese spot that we got takeout from a few weeks ago.
Okay. So you'd been hyping Chengdu Taste for quite a while. You went in a location in Vegas, which was also called Chengdu Taste, or a sister restaurant?
Sister restaurant. Yes.
Okay. So what did we go with as curated by Nate Duncan?
No, because it turns out the menu is pretty different from the spot in Vegas, which is called Mian. Is the place in Vegas. So there wasn't necessarily a lot of crossover in terms of what we were able to order from this spot. So let's see. I probably better pull up their menu as
well.
Did you
even ask Nate Duncan to curate this meal, though?
I did. Uh-huh. He just wasn't able to curate it in the way that we were hoping he would be able to.
It doesn't have to be the exact same meal. I just thought it would be fun to have a meal curated by Nate Duncan from afar.
All right, that would be fun. Maybe we'll have to do that at some other point. All right, so we ordered the flavored beef noodle, the crispy chicken with red chili pepper, tan tan noodle, beef with baby ginger, wonton with red chili sauce, toothpick lamb with cumin, Chengdu-style fried rice, cold noodle with garlic sauce. Now, this was also split with the famous cousin Katie and her husband, so you didn't try all of these dishes. I had pretty much all of them because I was able to skim them off the top before you came to pick them up.
And I'm sure that Katie got all the best dishes, the most highly reviewed dishes, the most talked about after.
Yes.
So, okay. Didn't know if you were going to say anything there. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's been so long that I don't know if I could really pinpoint. I know that there was a cold noodle. I know that there was ginger beef, which had tons of little jalapenos in it.
Yes. I mean, the number one thing, and this is not surprising for a Sichuanese restaurant, the spice level was considerable. And my mouth was on fire.
And the tan tan noodle. And, you know, for me, I basically just took everything and kind of put it all together on a plate. Little bits of each of the items, you know, because the sauces are fairly similar with the chili sauce, the chili oil that comes with it. And
yeah, it also may have screwed you because there was a bottle of a container of broth that I couldn't tell what it went with. And I assume in hindsight that it went with the tan tan noodle, which I didn't think were supposed to be like drenched in chili oil based sauce. But the version that we had when I ate it, I was like, whoa, this has no flavor. Clearly there was supposed to be something more.
I mean, I got a bunch of other sauces on there. You know, it worked out. My biggest takeaway from the entire meal was this was a pretty hyped meal by you throughout the last couple of weeks and reviews. And I think they were also written up in Seattle Times. And I just, you know, sometimes when you get a meal that's super hyped and it hits those marks, that is a truly special experience where you're like, damn, everybody was right. And for this one, it might have been the situation. I'll be totally honest. I don't know if I could actually judge the food that we were eating because, you know, I'm eating it, whatever, 45 minutes to an hour after you picked it up. It's takeout. I've got everything kind of jumbled together. I might even have the wrong sauces. Like, I don't want to be too confident in my review. But what stood out to me was that nothing tasted that special. And I think that was the difficult thing. Like, yes, it was spicy, but the flavor levels, they didn't rise above other Szechuan foods.
I think that's fair. I mean, it's the exact opposite of the experience that I had at Mian in Las Vegas, because it was just a place that we saw beneath the restaurant we had dinner at the day before. And we're like, hey, this looks good. Let's go there for lunch tomorrow. And then it was this awesome meal that Nate Duncan was compelled to go back to twice when he went back to Las Vegas later in the year. And so it was a different level of hype, different level of expectations. And I think the takeout aspect definitely hurt it. I mean, I didn't have it as long after the fact as you did, but still stuff was pretty cool. I had to heat up pretty much everything, not just from a safety standpoint during a pandemic, but just to get it to the right appropriate temperature. So my review is I'm probably good on going there for takeout at this point. I want to wait until, you know, we've gotten to the point where we can go dine in. And the other thing is you want to have a group of people go to this restaurant, share a variety of different dishes, try a number of different things as it was able to do in Vegas. And I'm going to wait until I can do that experience because I think they're probably going to be more on top of their game and the experience will be better.
It's also fairly brand new, right?
Yeah. Oh, it opened in, I think, soft opening maybe in October, full opening in November. So yeah. It's the location. So it's right next, it's not directly next door, but it's in the same complex as Dozone is in there in the International District. You were there a few weeks ago going to Hood Famous. And that's really become like a trendy food spot.
Oh yeah. Extremely good shit in that area. Well, I think for now we can give this an incomplete.
I agree.
I don't think we had the full experience. And, you know, as it was fine. I'm happy that we tried it. But I just don't think we can judge it that harshly at this point.
I would say the toothpick lamb and the crispy chicken with red chili pepper stood out of what I did have, which I'm not sure.
The two items that Katie got and I did not have.
Correct.
Totally
yes.
Makes sense. It's
the beef with baby
Christmas
good,
music so. Special of meals.
Okay, I wanted to quickly shout out a spot that to me has been the standout location of quarantine and takeout.
Wow.
And that's Baka Bak. Because there's a lot of places that I've enjoyed doing takeout from over the last 9 months that I already liked a lot. Baka Bak was a place I kind of had a fairly average rating of previously, but it has maybe been as good as any location I've been to for takeout over the last 9 months. So what I tried the last time, I mixed it up. Usually I go with the original chicken sandwich and the loaded tots or the dirty tots, which are the tots are the star of the show for sure. But this past time I tried their chicken strips, which I haven't had in a long time. And they seemed to imply when I looked at their social media that they have changed how they're doing the chicken strips.
Ah.
And they were way better than I remembered, ooh. A. And B, they had fish sauce as an option. And that was quite delicious. So
all
just
right.
Wanted to.
Shouts to Baka Bak. I haven't been there at all during this pandemic, which is not a sentence I thought I would ever say.
Yeah, you weren't expecting. I mean, it's also very convenient to me. They have locations in White Center where I'm frequently going for takeout food. And then a couple of weeks ago, we went outside, you know, we went socially distanced to the beach and on one of the last nice days. And I stopped in Burien on the way back from that. So,
all right, Baka Bak, move to Renton. Come on. It is time.
All right, you said you had bad news on the food front to share.
My bad news is, I'm curious if you know about this already. Can you see where that location is that I'm holding up for you?
It looks like the old Pagliacci in Queen Anne.
Did you know that Pagliacci in Queen Anne is closed?
I did know that Pagliacci in Queen Anne had permanently closed. This happened relatively early in the pandemic, I think.
Oh, the Pagliacci on Mercer. Maybe you told me about this and I forgot about it. But seeing it up close and personal was really something. And I just have to say, thank the Lord for that Dick's there. Because it is the last brick and mortar location that we have from our childhood in Lower Queen Anne.
I mean, the Blockbuster, Willie Wood, quite early.
Yeah. It's basically like my time at the Vera Project was defined by Dick's, Pagliacci, Mecca Cafe, which we can't go to anymore, Key Arena, which is now totally different. It's like the entire heart of Lower Queen Anne and Easy Street Records. I was pointing out, we were driving.
This is a little early. It's been gone longer, but Kid Valley too.
And Kid Valley, like I was driving through there this weekend and pointing out to Baby Fantasy Genius. I was like, hey, do you see that Chase Bank over there? Like, I saw Macklemore perform on top of that Chase Bank when it was a fucking record store. It's just like, he was like, why was Macklemore performing on top of a Chase Bank? And I'm like, long story. But seeing that Pagliacci go, I mean, it's one of the centerpiece Pagliacci locations where, you know, it's a huge location. It was a great place to go to if you're going to a sporting event, to a concert in the area. It's fast food. It's cheap. And you know it's always going to be good. We went there at the Vera Project, I don't know, 2 to 3 times a week for their after 4 p.m. If you ordered 2 slices, they give you a free drink. We were there constantly. Brought bands there when they were in town. Brought, you know, industry people were in town. Just like, hey, where's a place that I can go and have a quick meal that we know is going to taste good? Sent everybody to that Pagliacci, and losing that is devastating for Lower Queen Anne.
So I assume part of the reason behind it is there is a second location in Queen Anne, the one that's along Aurora Avenue. That's
a delivery location, though, or have they built it out to do slices now? Also,
I'm not sure about that. That was what I was looking up. There is a small counter for those coming to pick up an order, but this busy location is still predominantly a hub for delivery. But I assume that was part of it in a situation where dine-in wasn't the same option. The fact that they knew they still had a delivery hub in the Queen Anne area made it easier to do that.
I think this is a real loss for the Queen Anne neighborhood, losing that Pagliacci. And I understand that, you know, people can't dine in right now, but also it's a great place for takeout. I am incredibly sad to see it go. And it just feels like piece by piece, the heart of Lower Queen Anne is gone. Maybe things will come back, you know, with the new arena as a centerpiece. But that definitely
remains. And that's probably a factor. It's like part of your business was, a lot of your business was probably driven by events at Key Arena. So in addition to the pandemic before that, you already had this drop temporarily while construction goes on there.
Well, that corner doesn't feel the same as it used to.
I agree with that. I mean, the fact that I could recognize it off you holding up your phone to the screen is pretty remarkable, I will say. Shows you what it meant to us. All right, following up on that, not following up on that, but unrelated to that, but continuing from that, you have some grievances to air this week?
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
We should not be playing football during a pandemic. It's not safe for the physical or mental health of the players. Especially myself. That's right. We should not be playing fantasy football during a pandemic because the system is a fraud. I, unlike many others, pulled myself up by the bootstraps, scratched and clawed and earned, all caps, a spot in the Peltoncast Champions League for this season, ready to claim my rightful throne as fantasy genius. And something weird happened along the way. I scored the most points in the league, but somehow finished 8th in record for the season. I scored almost 300 more points, but finished behind a fucking person who literally did not know they cooked a turkey upside down.
Oh, no.
What do you think Jan wouldn't tell me? In the most unique of seasons, where I could watch every game from home instead of being at Lumen Field for half of the games, I woke up every single Sunday morning and watched my opponent's players have the game of their fucking lives. I lost because of defenses, because of kickers, because of a 3-touchdown Joe Mixon game, a historic Tyreek Hill game. If the points that were scored against me were a team, do you know where that team would have finished in the league?
I mean, I'm looking at it, so yes.
Third in the league, 2 points behind the number two team. Even though I scored the most points in the league, my point differential was less than 20 for this season. But am I bitter? No. Do you know why?
None of this sounds bitter.
Because you know what? Hang the banner. I did it. Most points scored at the highest of heights, competing against the champions of PeltonCast Fantasy Football, the best players from throughout all the PeltonCast Fantasy League. I did the thing they were all trying to do, which is score points. It is literally the only thing you can control in fantasy football, and I did it best. So, I won the championship. A new kind of champion. That's right. PeltonCast DVOA Champions 2020. You're welcome.
First off, I don't know that we should be playing football in a pandemic. We definitely don't want to make light of that at all. You know who you're playing against in the consolation playoffs in the PeltonCast Championship League?
Who? I truly don't know. I have not looked.
It's someone who finished 8th or 10th out of 12 teams in points, but won more games.
Is it you?
It is me.
My mortal enemy?
I mean, I would think you would take some consolation in being able to beat me in this scenario, but alas, no.
It is the only consolation that I take.
I will be back in the Champions League next year, having made the playoffs in the PeltonCast Economist Friends League.
Oh, great. You got to have two teams when you kicked my team out of the other league. In fact, you gave my team to Mrs. Fantasy Genius, who you were trying to kick out of the league for a long time, and she made the fucking playoffs, so she's going to be in the Champions League next year instead of me.
Yes. Yes. We'll wave to you from the Champions League.
If there's somebody who doesn't come back from the four playoff teams, I'm calling dibs on that spot.
Fine. Should we talk about non-fantasy sports?
God, I don't like talking about fantasy sports, so please.
Do you want to talk about the NBA at all this week? We're going to have, I assume we'll do our season preview next week, even though technically the season will probably have begun by the time we pod.
I think that's fine. And we're going to do, wow, we're already at the time of talking about the 10 players to watch.
I know, I have not prepared my list yet, but I better, I mean.
Wow.
You know, there's got to be, I guarantee you, I'll already give you this one, Facundo Campazzo,
a lock for the list.
An international rookie on the Nuggets,
He's on the Nuggets too? I was going to say, it's the annual Hernan Gomez trophy.
Oh, I mean, this goes all the way back to Nikola Jokic was probably on the list at some point, right?
I think both Jokic and Nurkic were on the list.
And Monte Morris for sure was on the list for the Nuggets.
Oh, yes.
So, a storied tradition of Denver players on this list. We really should come up with like an all-time list by team, etc.
There were some players that were already good by the time you had them on there.
They were already promising. I don't know if they were good yet. All right, let's talk about the Sounders, whose season came to a disappointing end in Saturday's MLS Cup final as they lost 3-0. At Columbus, a match that I think was actually closer than the final score indicated.
Oh, yeah.
If you go by expected goals based on the 538 Soccer Power Index model, it was 1.3 to Columbus, 0.6 to Seattle. I mean, there's no doubt the Crew were the better team. They were deserving champions, but I don't think it was as lopsided as the final score indicated or as one-sided.
Yeah, I mean, you know. We were talking about this after the match, and yeah, I think we both agreed the Sounders could have easily picked up a goal at some point. It felt like they were going to when it was 2-0. Yes. It felt like at some point before the 80th minute that they were going to get one goal and really make it a match. And also, it felt like Columbus could have scored two. It's like one of those two things is going to happen, and they seemed equally as likely to happen, and the thing that was bad for the Sounders ended up happening, and then the match was over at that point.
Yeah. I mean, Lucas Celarayan was awesome in this match. He was far and away the best player on the field, was involved in all three goals for Columbus. So, and Nico Ladero did not make the impact. Royal Ruidíaz did not make the impact you would expect. I do feel like the Sounders kind of looked tired, not to make excuses for them. They had one day fewer. It wasn't like a dramatic difference in terms of rest.
They might have looked a little sluggish. That's the thing about the MLS Cup finals. We talked about this before. It just, you watch it and you're like, you mentioned that Columbus Crew played in Seattle, the last match before they shut down the MLS season to begin with. And it wasn't like I remember that, the Columbus versus Seattle is just like, I remember watching the match. I didn't know who the fuck they were playing.
At that point you wouldn't. They were 20th in the league last year. Like, they weren't a notable team at that point.
And it still doesn't feel like, the stakes and the excitement of it, the stage, it's still not quite like, it's not the same as playing some of the other big American sports,
There was so much more hype last year because of the fact that the match was being played in Seattle.
The setting was more important than the match, it felt like.
Agreed with that, yeah. Whereas this year, even though there was so much excitement on Twitter about the West final and the comeback against Minnesota, it didn't necessarily translate into this being a huge talking point, I don't feel like. The only reason, by the way, that I remember that the Sounders had played Columbus in March is because I saw Celarayan's name and I was like, I know I've learned how to pronounce this before. Why do I know this? Oh, that's why. So that's what I discovered. Sounders now 2-2 in reaching 4 MLS Cup finals in the past 5 years. Not the same dynasty talk that there could have been if they had won their third title in that span. Still an incredible run. And the first thing we need to say here is we look ahead to 2021 and what's next for the Sounders in like 2 or 3 months when the MLS season begins again. Legitimately it's 3 months. You extend Brian Schmetzer. What the hell? Get it done.
Yep. It doesn't really make sense why it hasn't happened yet. But again, we compared this to Russell Wilson a couple weeks ago. It's going to happen. There's not a concern in my mind.
There's a little concern in my mind, but I don't think it's going to get to that point. And I really, really hope it doesn't, because Brian Schmetzer has meant so much to this franchise across multiple iterations of the Sounders, to the city, to soccer in this city. He's an icon. He's a legend.
Well, I just don't know if I agree with when you're talking about the dynasty. We talked about this again a couple weeks ago, which is the Sounders are that team. A dynasty doesn't necessarily need to mean that you win every single year, but it's about consistently dominating the league. And that's where the Sounders are definitely at with these appearances in the cup final. LeBron James had a dynasty and he didn't necessarily win the championship every single year, but it was like, and still to this day, LeBron James lost a lot of times, but it's still all part of the same dynasty. It's being at the top of your league consistently. And the way that soccer is structured, it's going to be something that, I'll knock on wood here when I say it, probably going to continue for the Sounders. They haven't missed the playoffs in their entire franchise history.
There's two ways to think about it with soccer. On the one hand, even though there is a salary cap in MLS, the existence of designated players and the rules there and, the size of your scouting staff, etc., your academy, all those sorts of things. There is a huge advantage financially. But on the other hand, MLS is different from EPL or La Liga in that those leagues don't have single elimination playoffs. So to win games as consistently as the Sounders have in the playoffs is still a remarkable thing. And also, by the way, speaks to, even without fans, how important the home field advantage has been for them, because, they've won some big road matches, certainly last year's West Final at LAFC, the first MLS Cup against Toronto, but they've been unbeatable when they've been at home.
Yeah.
So as far as the roster, the Sounders declined contract options on three players for 2021. Forward Justin Dillon, who was not a big factor this season, and midfielders Miguel Ibarra and Jovan Jones. Jones, most notable among that group since he started all the playoff matches for the Sounders. We'll see. You know, they can still negotiate and bring him back at a different salary than he was scheduled to make. Other players who are out of contract include midfielders Jimmy Madronda, who came on as a sub in MLS Cup, and Gustav Svensson. Defenders Kelvin Leerdam and Roman Torres, and goalkeeper Stefan Cleveland. Feels like from that group, they might move on from a few of those guys, given the age of Gustav Svensson and the emergence of Alex Roldan at right back as an alternative to Leerdam.
Totally. Absolutely.
And then João Paulo's loan from Botafogo is up, but Sounders indicated in the press release announcing these moves that they are, quote, currently in ongoing discussions with the club about his future. The Sounders, when they originally agreed to the loan for João Paulo, had the option to buy his contract at the end of the loan. So the fact that they're in discussions as opposed to just exercising that may indicate they're trying to renegotiate the terms in the wake of the pandemic. Either way, I think it's still reasonably likely that João Paulo is part of the team next year, especially like if they do move on from Svensson. In happier news, Charles Baim of MLSsoccer.com reported Tuesday that the Sounders have reached a 3-year contract extension with Nico Ladero, who had been set to enter the final season of his contract and had indicated that he wanted long-term assurance of where he was going to be. I presume that means the deal will be through 2023. So, you know, replacing the existing year with a new 3-year deal, though the article does not make clear whether it's that or adding 3 years to his deal.
Excellent. And, you know, the main thing is just preserving that core into the future, preserving in particular Jordan Morris, Rui Diaz, and Nico Ladero as the backbone of the Sounders team, and especially that attack.
Well, the one other thing we'll see about, and we haven't discussed on this podcast, is increasing rumors about Jordan Morris possibly making a move to Europe at this
Hello.
Point.
Hello.
Which, by the way, like, the U.S. owns Europe now. Every good young player is from the U.S., it turns out.
You see, like, a sprinkling of U.S. players, and every European country has every good young player in the world, and we're like, own Europe, dominate.
I mean, obviously, there are so many good young players that we're not hearing about in the same way because, you know, Roger Bennett isn't tweeting every time they score a goal or make an appearance.
Yes.
But this is pretty exciting for the U.S. soccer, the future of U.S. soccer.
Well, so I've got the FIFA 21 game and have been playing a manager career mode. And I guess a couple of things that I've noticed about that is, first off, they haven't fixed any of the glitches that the game has at all. No attempt whatsoever. Second off, this is the Nintendo Switch version, so I think it is like a mini version of the one that they would have on other platforms. But the transfer budgets for American clubs are now really high. Like, the Sounders transfer budget is $30 million a year, whereas, you know, before it might have been $8 million or something like that. You know, the numbers are pretty wild. I feel like they must have determined that, like, they need to make Americans better to have people be interested in the game in the States or something. Or just like, hey, this is a pretty big market for us. Let's just let them think that their soccer players are good. And when you look around the world and look at, you know, dynamic young players and players who are showing great potential, a lot of them are Americans, and it's pretty wild to see. You know, there's players that I personally obviously have never heard of, you know, outside of the Weston McKinneys, but like very young players who are just playing in deep academies of these clubs, FC Bayern and stuff like that. But there are a lot of very good young American soccer players out there in the world, and it feels like it's a totally different time period than it was a decade ago or two decades ago,
where we were so excited if it was just there was one guy. It was just Julian Green, and it was like, that was exciting enough on its own.
Yeah. Well, hopefully everything pans out better than it did for Julian Green.
I mean, the point of the beauty of it is having a lot of options.
Yes.
So the U.S. is coming for the one sport we currently don't dominate. No, I'm sure there's others. The one sport we now care about and don't dominate.
Care about at least a little. I love the idea that coming for it. Like, maybe before we're dead, the U.S. will play in like a round of 8 World Cup match. Like, it's going, this is a generations long thing.
For sure. And this is, of course, to be clear, on the men's side, because we already dominate on the women's side.
Yes.
Speaking of women's sports, let's jump ahead to UW women's basketball, which suffered a 60-52 loss on Friday versus Washington State, but bounced back on Sunday with an 83-56 win over Portland. Huskies really struggled early against the Cougs in that rivalry matchup, trailing 37-16 at halftime. They then outscored WSU 36-23 in the second half, but the rally came up short. Tamia Sadler, star freshman for the Huskies, had 8 points and six turnovers in that game, while Haley Van Dyke led the way with 19 points and 11 boards. The easy win Sunday over the Pilots came with Sadler sitting out due to rest, but the Huskies still had six players in double figures as they shot 65% from the field, led by Quay Miller's 21 points on 8 of 9 shooting.
I don't think I've ever seen a pulling a Kawhi in a college game.
I was surprised by that too. Like, I saw she wasn't in the box score. I was like, oh no. I mean, it being 2020, your first question is, did she test positive for COVID-19? And your second question is she injured? And it turned out it was neither of those things. So she will be back in the lineup this weekend as the Huskies host the Oregon schools on Saturday against number 7 Oregon and Monday versus number 21 Oregon State in an afternoon matchup, taking advantage of, you know, presumably people being at home to watch that ahead of the holiday. Ducks off to a 5-0 start without three WNBA first-round picks from last year: Sabrina Ionescu, who's the number 1 pick, Satu Sabale, the number 2 pick, and Ruthie Hebert, who later in the round of the Chicago Sky. Still 3-0 against Pac-12 opponents with a combined 71-point margin, including a 20-point win over the ranked Beavers in Corvallis. Wow. Oregon has five players averaging double figures, including five-star freshman Tahina Pau-Pau, who is, I don't want to call her the next Sabrina Ionescu, but that's too high expectations, but she's a very promising.
When did Oregon get this good at basketball?
The minute that they hired Kelly Graves away from Gonzaga, who the Huskies tried at one point to hire, could not lure him away from Gonzaga, but
wow.
Oregon got him, and it has been, since they got Sabrina over UW, at the very last minute, it has been a juggernaut.
Okay. Great.
Beavers still ranked despite back-to-back home losses to Utah and Oregon. So they'll be trying to get back on the winning side this weekend in the state of Washington. UW men's basketball showed more promise in the first homestand of the season, beating Seattle U 73-41 on Wednesday, and then competing against Oregon, one of the favorites in the Pac-12, in a 74-71 loss on Saturday. Down 17-15 midway through the first half, the Huskies outscored the Redhawks 58-24 the rest of the way, in a game that allowed Mike Hopkins to finish the game with walk-ons on the court, including his son. Quade Green had 18 points in 18 minutes off the bench after missing a couple of days of practice, while Nate Pryor took advantage of his first starting opportunity, the JC transfer, to post 13 points and 4 assists. Back to Pac-12 play on Saturday, the Huskies held the ball down 1 in the final 30 seconds, but Quade Green missed a deep 3 and Oregon survived. I think that was actually down 2. I think Green was taking a 3 to take the lead there, now that I think about it. Huskies benefited from 4 of 19 Oregon 3-point shooting in that one. Green was great before the final miss, scoring 26 points on 10 of 17 shooting. And Raekwon Battle, Raekwon cooked, coming off the bench for a career high 19 points on 6 of 11 shooting in a promising performance.
You got to alert me when these games are happening.
Well, it was opposite MLS Cup, so I was streaming that on the side, but
okay,
not paying real close attention to
this
it.
This is the first time finding out that this game even happened.
The Huskies did play Oregon on Saturday. It wasn't in football. We'll get to that.
Okay.
But they did play Oregon on Saturday. This week, they'll host Montana on Wednesday. Off to a 1-4 start, the Grizzlies, with their lone win versus Division II Yellowstone Christian College. In their first home game last Saturday, the Grizzlies suffered road losses at USC, twice at Southern Utah, and at Georgia. Hung in there versus both power conference opponents, losing by a combined 27 points. The Montana roster has basically completely turned over from the team that reached the NCAA tournament in 2018 and 2019 under coach Travis DeCure, a Seattle area native who played at Mercer Island High School. Then Saturday, or Sunday rather, the Huskies will play a non-conference matchup against Colorado, which is off to a 3-1 start with that lone loss coming at number 10 Tennessee. The Buffaloes lost second-round pick Tyler Bay from last year's team that went 10-8 in conference play, but bring back three starters headlined by senior guard McKinley Wright IV. Remember that this game is technically a non-conference matchup, as the Huskies and Buffaloes were set to play only once in conference play this season, that coming in Seattle. So, should be an opportunity on Wednesday to get another win over Montana, although not a sure thing. KenPom only given the Huskies about a 77% chance of victory in that one. Sunday's game, going to be a more difficult matchup against a Colorado team that's in the top 50 of the Pomeroy rankings. All right, let's talk about UW football. Pac-12 North champions. Who saw their final scheduled game at Oregon in their tentative Pac-12 championship game appearance versus USC, both canceled due to a COVID-19 outbreak on the roster. After initial isolated positive tests dating back to before the Utah game a few weeks ago, the Huskies received multiple positives last Tuesday, leading them to pause football activities. Per Mike Vorel of the Seattle Times, the team was well shy of the 53 scholarship player minimum to play last Saturday. They were still announced on Saturday night as North champions by virtue of their 3-1 record before the announcement Monday morning that the team would be unable to play and replaced by Oregon in the championship game this Friday. In a subsequent press conference, head coach Jimmy Lake indicated the team does not currently have any offensive linemen available due to a combination of positive tests and quarantines for close contacts, and they had not at that point, and have not indicated that they did today, achieved yet consecutive days without positive tests, which is necessary for them to be able to return to practice.
It's just, you know, I guess we had a good time watching a couple of these games. We recorded an emergency podcast. What a season. Like, I don't know. I do know why this season happened, and it happened for a couple of reasons. And, you know, I guess one of the reasons being that the players probably wanted to play, and I'm sure that that was at least some small factor. TV money was another very large factor. Also keeping up with the rest of the conferences in the country. And the thing that really sucks about this situation is we don't know about the health of these players, and we know nothing basically about them. I guess we can assume that most of them probably will be fine. Ultimately, we don't know what the long-term effects are. You know, we've seen, at the University of Florida with the basketball player that there could be negative long-term effects. Like, just saying that everybody's fine in the moment doesn't necessarily mean that it won't hit somebody very badly. And if you do end up with a player in a medically induced coma because you decided to play an ill-fated 4-game Pac-12 season, that's not a good trade-off. And
I mean, we don't know causation on Keontae Johnson, who collapsed during a game on Saturday and is now out of the medically induced coma, but, you know, had previously tested positive, according to multiple sources.
And, so, I mean, it's definitely a gray area exactly whether those are linked, but, you know, to me, I don't think this is worth it. And the other thing that just fundamentally does not make sense is there is a fucking answer to this. And the schools around the country, it's not necessarily the Pac-12's fault, but if this season had been pushed back to February, to March, to April, you know, we didn't know that there was necessarily a vaccine on the horizon, but by the time we get to those months, some people are going to be vaccinated. And, you know, maybe these schools could have actually had fans there and it would have been a little bit safer, you know? Or maybe they could have gotten some of the players vaccinated throughout that time period. Or the spread in the communities would be lower. Like, across the board, it was an easy decision to make that nobody wanted to make. And, you know, I think it really comes down to, again, the schools in the Southeast and the South that made this decision, and the unfortunate fact that this sport in general is dominated by states that have Republican governors that are not taking the pandemic as seriously as they should be. But we didn't have to play on their terms. Playing this 4-game season didn't make the Pac-12 look better. It didn't gain the Pac-12 anything. Nobody is playing in the fucking BCS championship, right? Like, we're going to have a game between a team that's 2-2 in the North and USC for the Pac-12 championship.
Three and two.
The Pac-12 North champion is not going to play in the Pac-12 championship because they don't have an offensive lineman. That's the season that we willingly walked into.
And was only the Pac-12 North champion because of the fact that their final game was canceled.
And we weren't blindsided by it. That's the other piece, is we all knew that this was coming from the very beginning.
I mean, I think the one thing I will say in the Pac-12's defense is that the reason we thought that it was understandable for them to start to play this season was the idea that daily, you know, rapid testing would potentially be enough to identify and isolate positive players before they could spread the virus to their teammates. And that turned out not to be the case.
But it turned out not to be the case early. Like, the Huskies had their first game canceled.
I mean, you couldn't know that at that point. It was canceled because of contact tracing. But as soon as Utah and Arizona State had the issues they had, it became clear that that was not sufficient to prevent spread within teams. And it's unfortunate because Seattle had been, knock on wood, doing extremely well during the pandemic in terms of having very few positive tests among their various sports teams.
Unless you're on an island and you're Australia or you're New Zealand, it's going to come for you. There's no, you know, there's no doing well that lasts forever. And it was going to come for UW sports, and it took a second longer, but it did.
And the baseball team did have to shut down their activities after some spread there. The other thing, I mean, that stands out, we talked about this Nas Carter situation last week, and don't know what the legal limitations were on what UW could say in that case, as he was being, you know, investigated on accusations of sexual assault. And in this case, we do know that teams have, you know, obviously there are some, you don't want to necessarily identify specific players as testing positive, but Oregon State has given a list of players who are unavailable due to either positive tests or contact tracing. We've seen that with other teams, Stanford, when Connor Weddington, Davis Mills IV were unavailable for their opener. And, you know, Jimmy Lake has said that the reason they're not going to discuss injuries or unavailability due to COVID-19 is competitive advantage. And I don't think in a situation where public health is at stake that that's an acceptable explanation.
Fuck that competitive advantage. That is such horseshit. I'm sad to hear that Jimmy Lake said that.
I mean, that was speaking generally, but we didn't know until Tuesday that they had positive tests going back to the Utah game, before the Utah game.
But we knew.
No, we didn't know at that point. No one missed the Utah game under suspicious circumstances in the same way as the Stanford game.
Oh, going back to the Utah game.
Yeah, this is way back. And, you know, the one thing that the UW medical staff made clear is for a long period of time, there was not a connection between the cases. It didn't seem to be a case where players were in fact spreading it within the team, but just different players were contracting it outside the team because of, you know, the base rate in the community is so high. But clearly that changed last week.
Well, I hope you're having fun with your competitive advantage while you're sitting at home watching the Pac-12 championship, Jimmy.
So Jimmy Lake did indicate the Huskies still intend to play in a bowl game to complete their season. The Pac-12 has 5 bowl tie-ins this year. Obviously, their champion will be in one of the Power 6 games, likely the Fiesta Bowl. The next up, presumably, is the Armed Forces Bowl versus an SEC opponent, which is replacing the canceled Las Vegas Bowl on December 31st. Then you've got the Alamo Bowl versus a Big 12 opponent on December 29th, the Cheez-It Bowl versus an ACC opponent the same day, in the Independence Bowl versus Army on December 26th. So we will see where among those the Huskies land next weekend.
Is there any chatter or anything? Or
The ESPN Bowl predictions that I looked at had, I think they both had Oregon is the loser of the championship game, presumably playing in the Independence Bowl. And one person had the Huskies in the Alamo Bowl, and I think the other in the Armed Forces Bowl. So, I don't know. Tomorrow is the early signing day for football, as the Huskies are expected to officially get a letter of intent from Sam Heward and 14 others. A class currently ranked in the middle of the Pac-12. Ultimate ranking may still depend on a decision by 5-star Eastside Catholic defensive lineman J.T. Tumalo, who could join five-star Stilicum wide receiver Emeka Egbuka in heading to Ohio State. So we'll see if the Huskies can win that recruiting battle.
This season, it was ill-fated from the beginning. It was doomed once it started, and it'll probably end that way. There's probably going to be bowl games that are canceled because
of course there will.
It's just the whole thing. I don't know who this is for. Elijah Molden has already said that he's not going to play in a bowl game. Is that correct?
I believe he said that, yes.
I hope nobody plays in a bowl game.
The reason that they've decided to play in a bowl game as opposed to Wazoo, you know, we saw Nick Rolovich say tonight that his team decided not to play in a bowl game because of the uncertainty of the season, and they had their game canceled against Cal, I believe 90 minutes before game time on Saturday because tests came back positive among the Cal team day of game. They decided not to play, but Jimmy Lake's message was that his team really wants to play, so you know, we'll hope that they can do that safely. All right, let's talk about the Seahawks, who fixed the offense. And everything's better now with their 40-3 win on Sunday against the New York Jets.
And it was a great moment in modern accountability, is the way that I really saw it. You know, just the accountability, as the Jets come into town, the accountability gets higher. And I think that's the thing that we really have to consider is, I didn't see completed passes. I didn't see touchdowns. I saw accountability out there on the field. And I think that was huge for the Seahawks on Sunday.
It was a 37-point win for accountability. I don't know, is there much to take away from this game?
The offense did look different than it has. You know, I think there was an intention to get the ball out quickly. And that is not something that the Seahawks have necessarily done all season. The passing game in particular, you look at Russ's yards per attempt, I would have to guess that it was one of the lowest of the season.
Not quite that far, but it was, I think, a below average game in that regard.
And maybe one of the other games have been lower because of actual defensive competition. right? Yes. Like, for different reasons. But the intention was not to push the ball down the field in this game as much as it has been in the past. And while we all love that, I still don't think it's the perfect offense. I think the perfect offense is a combination of all of these things: being able to throw the ball short and get the ball quick when you need to, and then also push the ball downfield, which they tried, and there's the ball that David Moore dropped. But deep passes are important to good offense.
Yes.
Deep passes are more important than ball control to good offenses.
It was 7th out of 13 games this season in terms of yards per attempt for Russell Wilson. Okay. I don't have yards per completion handy from the Pro Football Reference.
Not actually that bad.
I mean, the win over Arizona is probably a more extreme example of this, where Russell Wilson completed 82% of his passes for only 7 yards per attempt. So certainly the lowest yards per completion there. But yeah, I mean, the Moore completion would have made his day look entirely different statistically, but just everyone, I think everyone came out feeling well, and more than anything, the Seahawks just needed this game to like calm everyone down after the week before.
We'll see. I don't know if people are calmed down. I think that people are dormant for a second here, but the takes are ready for this game on Sunday. And I hate these games against really bad teams where it's just only bad stuff can happen. If you play a close game, that's bad. And if you crush the Jets, it's like, that's fine. You know?
They outperformed expectations. Said before the game that you would never take the Seahawks as a 16-point favorite under any situation.
I still stand by it. They somehow managed to win by 37 points, but I still stand by that. You know,
It didn't hurt that the Jets, A, settled for 3 field goals, and B, missed all 3, or I guess they settled for 4 field goals, and B, missed 3 of the 4 field goals.
Adam Gase, just in actual earnestness, trotting out his kicker down 20 points without a win in this season.
Wow, where's the accountability there?
Like, It is. He is going to go out the only way he knows, and that is kicking field goals when he should be going for it.
I mean, in fairness, with Sam Darnold as quarterback, I'm not sure you should be going for
it. They missed three field goals. Sergio Castillo is their kicker. Like, you know what? Give me Sam Darnold over that.
I mean, it was exciting to see Geno Smith actually get in a football game for the first time since 2018. The first time a backup quarterback has played a snap for the Seahawks since 2017. So it's been a minute.
But no, there are not tons of takeaways. You know, I think the Jets offense, people had pointed this out. They'd been doing some things before this. You know, the Jets had not been throttled like the Seahawks beat them. They basically beat a playoff-bound Raiders team. Like, but you're not going to take a ton away from it. But I do think that the defense played fairly well in this game.
They are moving up the DVOA rankings a little bit. They have moved into the top 20 at number 19 overall in DVOA.
I don't think the defense is... I don't think you can call the defense bad at this point. I think they have risen to the level of below average.
Oh, there you go. I mean, now the one thing is that's being based on full season adjustments for the Jets. And the Jets played four games started by Joe Flacco, who was dramatically more effective than Sam Darnold has been. Oh, yeah. His QBR is 58. Sam Darnold's QBR is 37.
I mean, I don't think you can do that, though, because they played the Cowboys with Dak Prescott.
True. But just for this game in specific, I do think you can do that. As we look to the week ahead, lots of players with a chance to play this week, but uncertain status. Carlos Dunlap, who sat out last week.
That pulling a Pete Carroll. Having a chance to play, but uncertain status. That's where Pete Carroll lives.
I think that's not going for it on 4th-and-3 from the 41-yard line. That's actually the Pete Carroll. Quentin Dunbar, who has been on IR. Brandon Shell, who played last week but left the game midway through and was replaced by Chad Wheeler. And his backup, Cedric Ogbwehi, who was not able to play last weekend. And those are particularly important when we look ahead to the Washington football team defense in a moment here. And also running back Rashad Penny could make his long-awaited return after a couple weeks practice, while DeMontre Moore is eligible to return from his PED suspension this week. We'll see what the Seahawks do there.
And next week is the first week that Josh Gordon can possibly play?
Yes, week 16, yes.
Has he been practicing with the team? Has he cleared COVID protocols?
I don't think he's allowed to practice with the team, but he's allowed in the facility now, having cleared COVID testing.
Okay, great.
So he can work out on his own. Let's talk about the Washington football team, because break up the football team, and not just because they might actually have a name next year, have won 4 in a row after a 2-7 start to take over first place in the NFC East, including handing the Steelers their first loss of 2020. This makes them the third different NFC East leader we have previewed on this podcast this season as the Seahawks tour the division. The football team has gone 4-1 in Alex Smith's 5 starts this season, but finished Sunday's win over the 49ers with original starter Dwayne Haskins, who went 1-3 as a starter at quarterback, as Smith left due to calf tightness at halftime. His status for this week remains uncertain. Haskins went 7-12 for 51 yards in that appearance after halftime, which was actually better than Alex Smith had been in the first half, but football team was able to win that with 2 defensive touchdowns. Smith hasn't been particularly good in his miraculous return from the devastating injury he suffered back in 2018, ranking 33rd in Dakota this season, ahead of Sam Darnold and Carson Wentz among qualifying quarterbacks. But Haskins, who is 42nd of 43 in the same measure when you drop the qualifying number of plays to 100, ahead of only Jake Luton of the Jacksonville Jaguars, has been even worse. Rookie Antonio Gibson has been a top 10 running back by DR this year, really excelled in wins over Cincinnati and Dallas, combining for 209 yards on 36 carries, but then suffered a toe injury early in the win over Pittsburgh and did not play last week. Peyton Barber got the plurality of the carries, but the majority of the snaps went to our old friend JD McKissick, who has been frequently used out of the backfield as a receiver. He had 11 carries for 68 yards on Sunday and is number 2 among running backs this season with 58 catches. We always knew about JD McKissick. Second-year receiver Terry McLaurin has topped 1,000 yards already, putting him 10th in the NFL, but just 39th in DR. His 8.8 yards per target, still far and away tops among Washington football team regulars. Nobody else with more than 30 targets is averaging more than 6.2 yards per target. So definitely want to keep McLaurin quiet. One-time Arizona quarterback Logan Thomas has emerged as a threat at tight end, catching 9 of 9 targets for 98 yards and a touchdown at Pittsburgh. Much more than the offense, Washington's winning streak is about the team's defense, which ranks number 4 in opponent EPA per play during the winning streak behind the Rams, Saints, and Steelers. Also number 4 in defensive DVOA over the course of the season. Seem to really like that number 4. They rank there in both opponent yards per attempt passing and sack rate. A deep pass rush is led by 2019 first-round pick Montez Sweat, who has 7 sacks, with 5.5 apiece for both veteran Ryan Kerrigan and number 2 overall pick Chase Young, who had a 47-yard fumble return on touchdown on Sunday and forced another fumble on a different play. Young ranks 9th in pass rush win rate, according to ESPN's metrics, as a rookie, so he has made quite an impact. Washington not quite as good against the run, ranking 10th in rush defense DVOA as compared to number 2 in pass defense. So I think this is going to be a game that Pete Carroll is going to try to run the football.
Oh, yeah, it's coming. You can feel it coming. And a terrifying, terrifying game that the Seahawks are playing.
I mean, the number one goal in this game is to not give up a defensive touchdown, I feel like.
Well, let's just take a step back and say the number one goal in this game is not to have anybody get injured.
That's fair.
And seriously, because again, you know, we saw Joe Burrow's season end at the hands of the Washington football team. And that's what we care about the most of anything. But not giving up a defensive touchdown, not giving up turnovers is going to be huge in this game. And you know, they remind me, the obvious teams, I think, are the number one team we think of is the 2011 Seahawks. You know, a team that especially put it together in the second half of the season. Their defense totally came together. You know, they managed at that time to find a quarterback the next year. We'll see if Washington can do the same thing. But they do feel like they have their defensive core there. And then,
I mean,
also,
if they draft a top 5 quarterback in the NFL in the 3rd round, Washington is going to be very scary.
Fingers crossed. And then also you look at some of those Jaguars teams too, of teams that are, you know, average to below average on offense, but have a very, very scary defense, and a very scary, generally young defense too. And it's not a fun game to go into for any team. I do think that the schedule paid them a few favors during this win streak though. You know, you look at it, it's 4 games. There's the game that Burrow went out in. They crushed the Cowboys when, was Dalton starting then?
I don't know if he was back.
And then you have a Steelers team that I think was pretty on the brink of fading. You know, it's still a great win, but like...
He was back. That was the Thanksgiving Day game, for the record.
And then also the 49ers playing Nick Mullins. So you look at it, it was 3 out of 4 backup quarterbacks that they played. And, you know, the Steelers win was a great win. Still feels like kind of a wonky game because of how it happened. And again, you know, the Steelers haven't looked the same the last couple of weeks. So I do think that they're playing some inferior offenses. And I don't think you could just say that the team put it together when all of a sudden they had a run against some poor offenses. But they didn't have it when they played against the Cardinals, the Browns, the Ravens, the Rams in a row, right? They gave up 30 plus points to all of those teams in consecutive weeks. And I'm not sure if I buy into the story of like, well, they figured out how to play defense, because those wins happened and those points that they gave up, they gave up. And maybe the defense has gotten significantly better in its time period, or maybe they're playing worse competition. So what does Russell make
if you want to make the case they've gotten better, I think the strongest argument is that they needed some time to adjust to a new scheme. They were previously a 3-4 defense, switched to Ron Rivera's 4-3 and Jack Del Rio as defensive coordinator. And that, I think, was an adjustment. And then you mentioned the youth. You do expect younger players to play better over the course of the season.
I mean, but defense is going to improve over the second half of the season. But I'm just saying that typically...
They did give up 30 points to the Lions a month ago.
And you say the Seahawks, the offense is fixed when they play the Jets, right? Like, a lot of the narratives that happen throughout the NFL, because the schedule is so lopsided, narratives that happen in the NFL happen because of scheduling almost always. And this is a situation where I would never go into this game confident, but I think there are takeaways to be had about the Washington football team where you can look at it and say, you know, they just weren't playing very good offenses. And when they did play very good offenses, they gave up 30 plus points to every single one of those. And if that happens in this game to the Seahawks are going to win if they score 30 points in this game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, we'll see whether it's Alex Smith or Dwayne Haskins at quarterback on Sunday. I feel like 17 points might win this one.
Oh, I mean, if Dwayne Haskins is starting, it's game on. Like, you can't take it for granted. I think Dwayne Haskins is significantly worse than Colt McCoy is, you know, who they played a couple weeks ago.
I mean, at the end of the day, the Giants scored what offensively in that game? They finished with 19 points, right?
If you gave me Washington 17. Scores, how many? 17?
Yes. And
if you gave me Washington scores from 19, do the Seahawks win? I'm not ridiculously confident.
That's fair. Yes.
But, you know, either side could have defensive takeaways in this game if Dwayne Haskins is starting. And I think it's a totally different setup. And the defenses are going to be scary. It's probably going to be a defensive battle. But the Seahawks defense is up for it, I think, in this way, especially playing against a quarterback, either Alex Smith or Dwayne Haskins. But this defense that we've seen over the second half of the season, ding, 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 a defense that is getting better, rising in DVOA, not at the same level that Washington football team is, but all of a sudden you play against Colt McCoy, you play against Carson Wentz, you play, right? You play against Sam Darnold. Oh, the defense is getting better. It's about situation. And these opportunities weren't necessarily coming up when you're playing against good offensive attacks, when you're playing against the, you know, the Rams, when they're dealing with Jared Goff or Kyler Murray a couple times in a few weeks. Like, it is, the situation is important to consider, and they didn't give up that much to any of these quarterbacks, to Wentz, to McCoy, to Sam Darnold. So, like, I think we're going to see more of that same, and I think the Seahawks defense is going to make plays and have opportunities to make even further plays. And it really comes down to, can the Seahawks not give up a defensive touchdown, two defensive touchdowns, and can they have a couple of drives? Can they get to 24 points? Can they get to 21 points even? And I think if you get there, they have a very good chance of winning this game.
Fun fact, Alex Smith has a higher interception rate this season than Dwayne Haskins. He's been picked 6 times, but Haskins has fumbled 4 times in his 5 appearances.
Give me Dwayne Haskins. As opposed to
just one fumble for Alex Smith. Oh, I mean, I agree.
If we're deciding between the two here, I do not think that Dwayne Haskins is an NFL quarterback. You know, neither of them look great. You know, the touchdown interception ratio for Alex Smith is lopsided.
But before he went out on Sunday against San Francisco, Alex Smith in the first half was 8 of 19 for 57 yards.
And I mean, I think Kyle Allen has been their best quarterback that they've played all year so far.
Yeah, in the games he played did not coincide with their defense being as strong. So that's why the team only went 1-3 in those games.
But it's just, okay, whatever. Great.
I'm just explaining that because people are going to look at it like they went 4-1 with Alex Smith. How could he not be their best quarterback? Because people think wins are a quarterback stat.
Quarterback wins. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very good of Dwayne Haskins / Alex Smith to score those two defensive touchdowns on Sunday.
Willed them to happen.
That was monster. You know, but I don't think either of them is good. And the Seahawks have proven, honestly, more so than they were able to last year, to have played fairly well against bad quarterbacks defensively. And that's something that I think early in the season we didn't necessarily expect to happen. And, you know, we saw with A. McCown playing against them in the playoffs last year. Like
Matt Schaub.
This defense, for the most part, they shut down Carson Wentz. They shut down Colt McCoy. They shut down Sam Darnold. And those are the worst quarterbacks that they've played all year. Otherwise, they've played a pretty strong slate of quarterbacks.
Nick Mullins?
And they shut... Well, I don't know. You know, that was garbage time.
They shut down Jimmy G. They did not shut down Nick Mullins.
It was garbage time that Jimmy G came in. But like... I have been more impressed by the Seahawks defense in the second half of the season than I thought I would.
Yeah, I agree that they've exceeded expectations. I'm, you know, still concerned when the Los Angeles Rams come to town.
That's not what we're talking about. Look, we're all concerned for when the Rams come to town. That's not the question, though. The question is, this isn't where Sean McVay was offensive coordinator, right? This is Alex Smith or Dwayne Haskins. And
this is true.
They will be looking at the schedule, one of the four worst quarterbacks that they play all year. And they have all together these 4 weeks, the four worst quarterbacks that they play all year. And the defense has been playing fairly well through those games. They managed to lose one because the offense couldn't generate offense 2 weeks ago. And look, am I over it? Of course I'm not. Still thinking about that Giants game. It's like, it's one that lingers. And
especially after the Saints lost to the Eagles last week, and a golden opportunity.
It's a devastating loss. And also seeing just how badly the Giants play the next week. But like, we have to move on. And the thing is, whether it's Alex Smith, whether it's Dwayne Haskins, this is going to be one of the four worst quarterbacks that they play throughout the entire season. And they've done fairly well in those previous three games. And I don't see any reason to expect otherwise in this one.
The only time the Seahawks played against Sean McVay as offensive coordinator in Washington was a 27-17 win on Monday Night Football. So he did not have the same mastery over them yet.
We won that game, Monday Night Football? Was that there?
Yeah.
There was a like offsides play. We won that game?
In 2014, yes.
Huh. I remember losing that for some reason.
The Washington came to town and won a game here, but that was long after Sean McVay was in LA.
Kirk Cousins dealing. It was like he had that bomb. I can just picture myself in the stadium watching Kirk Cousins throw that pass, and I can't remember who the receiver was, but he just dove for the ball and made this miraculous catch on the open side of the stadium, and it was like, oh wow, we're gonna lose. I remember there was some sort of offsides play in that Washington game on Monday Night Football.
I don't know. I left that one already. I was watching that one, I remember, in Portland at the Buffalo Wild Wings near the Moda Center. And that was a tough watch. The 17-14 loss in 2017 at home.
It's like just like that Giants game. I'm still thinking about it.
Russ passed too many times. 24-45 in that one. They were doomed.
We're on the damn ball.
I was going to say, by the way, you know, sure, Russell Wilson completed 75% of his passes and the Seahawks won by 37 points on Sunday, but he threw an interception, so the game was terrible.
It has to be brought up. Look, you make a great point. And you know why it has to
That's
be brought
accountability.
Up? Accountability. Yeah. And if Russ isn't going to be accountable to us, who is he going to be accountable to?
Clearly no one in the Seahawks organization, that's for sure.
Yeah, they're just not willing to top to bottom hold anybody accountable. Lord. This is a terrifying game.
Oh, but the one not terrifying thing about this game.
What is that?
So it's going to snow on the East Coast tomorrow. Or Wednesday, probably today as you're listening to this. But on Sunday, the forecast is for 45 degrees and sunny.
Hello!
With approximately 10% chance of rain during the game window. And after a game where it did not start pouring until Russell Wilson was safely out of the game. That is exciting.
Big news. It would be kind of fun to play a snow game. Just for like, fuck it, let's... You know, we know that the last couple aren't going to be.
When was the last time the Seahawks played a snow game?
It's been forever.
By the way, breaking news, the Seahawks will not be having fans at that Rams game.
Yeah, I called it right after when they announced that they weren't going to have fans for the first three games. And I said that I could break right in that moment that they wouldn't have fans for the final five games either. Thank you. No Sir Tristan right there. I know that we're playing football during a pandemic. Thank you.
The third wave timing up with the season was not ideal in that regard. No.
This is all the first wave, baby. There's no third wave going on. We're in one long first wave.
I don't agree with that whatsoever.
It's been a very long time since they played a snow game. Basically, I feel like in Russ's entire career, they haven't.
probably could use NFL Fast Start to look this up, but that might take too long.
Well, I can't think of a game that Russell Wilson has played where it's been, you know, there was the super, super cold game, the Minnesota playoff game, but it wasn't actively snowing.
No, no, it was not.
That's the only one that I can think of where, yeah, I can't really remember any other ones. So weather will be good, which is great. And I think really what we have to come down to is, yes, does Washington have a terrifying defense? Of course they do. Are we excited about playing this terrifying defense? Absolutely not. Especially them back-to-back, seeing Chase Young and Aaron Donald in two consecutive weeks is not fun for anybody at all. But the Seahawks top to bottom are a better team than the Washington football team. And I do think that we get a little bit confused with leading their division and being good. And I don't think those two things are the same. You know, people are so hyped on the Giants, and it's like, everybody, can we please calm the fuck down about this team that is under 500? And I think that's a little bit of what's happening with Washington right now, is just because they're leading their division and just because they've played a few good games against bad teams doesn't mean that they're a good team. You know, Nick Mullins still pushed them pretty hard. And we've seen some pretty brutal Nick Mullins performances this year. I think the Nick Mullins is better than Jimmy G. The steam behind that has kind of been lost this season.
It's not been a great year for Nick Mullins.
So, you know, I haven't seen the spread, but I do think that chances of winning hover. I would say it's a 65% chance winning this game.
I think you're more optimistic than I am. I'm like 55 if Alex Smith plays, and like 60 with Haskins.
They're not a good enough team. Like,
but they're not a good enough offense, but they are a good enough team, especially on the day.
Where is their DVOA? I didn't see that. What is their overall DVOA?
I think it's like, it's somewhere between 60. It's either 16th or 18th.
And where did the Seahawks move up after that Jets win?
They moved up slightly. They're 8th, I believe. I mean, Seahawks favored by 5.5 in this one.
Which does not equate to a 55% chance of victory.
It's about 60, somewhere in the neighborhood of 60.
So they are a better team. And people with clearer minds outside of the city of Seattle can see that. And I think it's very hard for us to have clearer minds when we're here and we're scared. Look, I don't blame people for being scared. It's going to be a terrifying game, whether the Seahawks win or not. But this is a game they're going to win.
50% of the time, it works every time.
And also, they've been shockingly good at playing 10 a.m. starts on the East Coast.
That is accurate, yes.
So, can we get Brian? This is totally unrelated. Can we get Brian Daboll a head coaching job? By the way, remember what I was saying, that when you see a really good offensive coordinator, you know what their name is? Head coach. Brian Daboll this year. Man.
Well, as long as it's not before Eric Bieniemy.
Well, no, definitely not. There's head coaching jobs for everybody. I don't know if you know this, but Adam Gase
you get
is
a head coaching job. You get a head coaching job. I don't know if there's for everybody.
There's a lot of jobs out there.
There's enough for both of them to get them.
Already a couple, but
somehow it's going to be like a former special teams coach who's coaching in the Big Ten is going to get the job.
And I'll tell you why.
Oh no!
Accountability.
Oh,
that's what they bring
note
to the table. Oh, thanks for listening.
Thanks.